Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 469. And what a guest I've got for you this week. This guy was previously on, I can't remember now, we talk about it in the episode, maybe 2015, maybe 2014, but it's Paddy Considine, one of my favourite guests and one of my favourite actors and one of my favourite people. And this was such a nice chat. Since that first episode, we've kept in touch on and off, and there's been ups and downs and big changes in both of our lives. And Paddy might not realise how crucial he's been to some of them changes in mine, or he may not have until we had this conversation, because I was insistent on letting him know. If this is your first time tuning in, I should mention we've had a load of great guests. Go and check out the multiple Stephen Graham episodes, the multiple Florence Pugh episodes, Vicky McClure, Kathy Burke we talk about in this episode. Had loads of amazing people on. So yeah, plenty for you to go and check out there. If you're a fan of the podcast, then you can support by buying merch over at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Me and Paddy talk a bit about music and the music industry, so that's relevant there. There's patreon.com/ScroobiusPip, where you can get loads of exclusive info, or not loads, actually, a tiny, minuscule amount of exclusive info, barely any, but it's only $1 a month, so so be grateful, all right? And twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipYo is where I'm rambling on all the damn time. We talk about Paddy's huge new show in this episode, so I want to get straight into it, because we talk about a lot. Man, we fit a lot into an hour. Honestly, this is going to fly by. Forever grateful to Paddy for all of his work and just for the human that he is. So let's get into it. This is episode 469 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Paddy Considine. You got it?
Yeah. Right, we're good.
We're good. I'm joined today by Paddy Considine. How are you, sir?
I'm all right, Pip. I'm not too bad, mate. I'm feeling quite well, actually.
Yeah, that's good to hear. That's good to hear. It's kind of the standard now when anyone catches up, because it's been a mad few years, isn't it? And we'll get into it. Work-wise, it's been a mad few years for you as well. But is everything good? Are you holding it all together okay? Are you feeling in a good place in yourself?
Yeah, I am. You know, I turned a massive corner recently, and you know, it's been a really, really good time. I just feel well mentally and, you know, physically and that. And yeah, I just feel like I don't know. I just might have grown up a little bit, Pip. You know, and you know, just sort of let a few things loose that have been bothering me for way too long. You know, I just feel a bit lighter, and you know, so it's good.
It's so weird, isn't it, when these kind of breakthrough moments happen. I've had a few things like that, where there's been things that have been a massive part of my life or a massive weight on my mental health, and then suddenly they're just not. Do you know what I mean? All of a sudden, it's not even like, I don't feel there's been particular things I've done the work or got over this. It's just at a certain point I've gone, oh, that doesn't actually matter, does it?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it's a lighter life as such, you know?
Yeah, and also, like, you know, looking at time again, I haven't got the time to carry this around with me anymore, you know? Yeah. It's stopping me from being a man, I suppose, you know, in a way. It's 48 years old, you know? I can't look down the path now and be carrying shit that I've been had with me since I was a kid or a teenager. It's just time to sort of move on from it all, really.
100%. And you mentioned feeling good physically as well. Are you looking well, mate? Are you exercising? Like, what's going on? Has that been part of your kind of breakthrough at all?
Yeah, I think, yeah, I've always sort of exercised, but I think my diet was the biggest thing from time to time, you know.
Mate, tell me about it. The diet is the thing that when you're a bit younger, it looks after itself. And then when you start to get to those 40s or whatever, you start going, I can't keep doing this, can I? Yeah. I can't keep.
It's not quite shifting like it used to.
Yeah.
So
I know it well.
You got to be on top of all that stuff. Well, yeah, I just think there's a, you know, we can look after ourselves a bit better now. It's not like people who are nearly 50, like I suppose, or I am, I'm 49 in a few weeks' time. Mm. Dad's like my father, people of their generation, they looked a lot older than we did, you know. Yeah. I think we learned to look after ourselves a little bit better.
And the generation before as well. Like it blows my mind that my dad is the same age as my granddad was. And it's like, it doesn't look, that doesn't, like my granddad felt like an old man. My dad just feels like he's a bit older, but it's weird, isn't it? How, we're getting better at looking after ourselves, I guess.
I think so. And things are changing all the time, aren't they? Even with psychology and things like that, you know, it's all changing. So
it really is. Well, I mean, speaking of time passing, last time I had you on was April 2015.
God.
It's a long time ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's one of the early days, and a lot's gone on since then that I want to talk about. More than we'll have time to, I'm sure, but I want to talk about Peaky Blinders, I want to talk about Journeyman, I want to talk about The Outsider, I want to talk about The Ferryman, I want to talk about Riding the Low, and I probably want to talk a little bit about combat sports, and I, of course, want to talk about your latest project, this huge Game of Thrones prequel, House of Dragon. But before all that, I just want to thank you, mate, because I've not really said, but during that podcast and after that podcast, you really gave me a kick up the arse to get into acting, and it's changed my life, mate. It's now just everything I care about, and everything I don't. I bumped into you a year or two after the podcast as well, and you is when you were doing The Journeyman, I think, and you were trying to then convince me to get into doing theatre. But one step at a time, mate. One step at a time. But you were really, there was a lot in the podcast that I think I held off for a long time because I'm working class. I had no family in the industry. And I didn't feel I was allowed. And our conversation and a few of the things that we discussed afterwards, you kind of said to me, that just start now. Like, you're not that you're running out of time, but now's as good a time as any. And it's everything now. So I really appreciate it, man.
Oh, no, Pip, you're welcome, mate. You're welcome. I mean, that's just something, that's one of the things that I turned a corner with lately was this, you mentioned their working class, and it's such a strange relationship we have to the arts. There's so many great artists that come from working class, you know, backgrounds, but it's a really strange thing that we put these restrictions on ourselves for some reason, and that it's these things are only for privileged people. But we look at the amount of working class actors who, like Anthony Hopkins, for example, one of the greatest actors that ever lived.
Yeah.
You know, why do we do that to ourselves? Why do we put ourselves so far down the line? You know, I think we rob ourselves of opportunities and experiences if we carry that mentality around with us.
Yeah.
You know, you've just got to learn that you have a sense of entitlement. You're entitled to anything, no matter where you're from. You're entitled to read Shakespeare. You're entitled to enjoy art, and you're entitled to act. And I think I've learned to stop apologizing about things and just gone, you know what, whether I'm good in some things and not so good in others, I'm here and I'm doing it. And all I've ever done is try to get better at it. And I'm just doing my absolute best. I just don't, from here on out, I just don't want anything to hold me back anymore. I think it's sad that you feel like you have to apologize for your talent in some way. And that somehow comes from that working class mentality that you're not good enough. And it's all just nonsense.
Yeah. And I think you're exactly right there. That feeling that you need to apologize for the things that make you special, the things that make you unique. I've had that a few times. I was lucky that my second ever acting gig, really great casting director, Amy Hubbard, and they kind of said it was a bit of a medieval thing, and I'm there. It happened in my first and second, actually, with Reg Puriscout Edgerton, because they were both medieval because of the way I look. I turned up, again, not knowing what I'm doing, and tried to do the medieval voice that you've seen in TV and film all the time. Yeah, and they both said, your voice is fine. And on both of those things, I got feedback that the reason I got the job was because it was filming in Britain and it was medieval. All the drama school kids were doing your Shakespeare performance voice. And I was there going, obviously doing their dialogue, but just in my voice. And that's what made me stand out. And in recent years as well. I've not got to use it yet, but on the scripts I'm working on, I've started writing my stammer into it because I've got a stammer and I'm fine with that. I've always had it. I get rid of it for roles, but equally, yeah. It could make me unique in a role because a stammer is uncontrollable. And that's what we're looking for, that truth. It's uncontrollable truth. So,
yeah
there's been a lot of things like that in recent years. Again, no, actually, I don't need to be apologetic almost that I've got a stammer and I'll work it out. I'll get through it. It's like, no, that could be a key part, you know, an exciting part. And it's the same with a working class and all these things.
Yeah, you bring yourself to it, you know. And the only thing that was missing from my game, Pip, I felt was a bit of like, schooling. It's almost like we're afraid to say, I'm going to do some training. Well, fighters train. If they don't train, they get their arse handed to them.
Yeah.
So what's the problem with me wanting to learn how to be a better actor?
Yeah.
And I was always striving for that because I felt that there was a part of my game that was missing. I had ability. I definitely had ability to be other people and behave as other characters. But I just felt like there was, you know, I lacked something technical in what I was doing, you know, and I could see it in my performances. And, you know, eventually I got a role in a play that allowed me to confront those particular demons. And also it took me to school. I went to school during that period of time. You know, we ended up doing it in the West End, then on Broadway. And I felt like that was a major thing for me because all of a sudden I felt like I became an actor during that time. I thought, okay, all these, I felt brave enough to step out now and you know, just try out new things. And I learned technique and repeating that show over and over again, night after night. It was the best exercise I could have had and the best school I could have had.
I love that. And there's a beauty in that, isn't there, in the repetition of it, in finding the nuance and honing these things. Rather than TV and film, it can be prep. It happens, it's over. Do you know what I mean? You're doing all of this to find the character and then it's 3 weeks of shooting or 7 weeks or 4 months or whatever it is, a certain period of shooting, and then it's over and you're on to the next thing and you kind of can forget what you did almost there. But I'd imagine, doing a show like that, you're confronting it every night and you're knowing what's not working and what is working and what your weaknesses are.
Yeah, you've got to go out that stage and tell that story like it's the first time you've ever told it because there are people there experiencing it for the first time, and you've just got to go learning that technique of just going out and telling the story every night was something as well that blew my mind because I had a chip on my shoulder. It was me versus them. I had something to prove in that place. Like, I'm going to show these fuckers what I can do. I'm going to take it all on that stage. And then when I was doing Broadway, I was just coming down the stairs one night and I had this revelation. And it was just this thing lifted off and it's when all you got to do is tell the story. And I just went, ugh. And it's like, there's no us and them. There's no you in the audience. And fucking, all you got to do is tell the story, Paddy.
Yeah.
And that was a massive moment because it took a weight off my shoulders. And I feel that from that point onwards, about three quarters of the way through that run, I think I finally understood what it meant to be an actor. It's like, you just got to tell the fucking story.
Yeah.
You haven't got to, you know, you haven't got to rake over you the coals of your past. And dredge up shite, you know. You just go and tell the story. Those things are all there, and that technique. I was a guy acting on film who just hated doing take after take. You know, I think if you haven't got it in the first three, it's a load of bollocks. You know, the magic's gone. Learning, having to do take after take, particularly on House of the Dragon as well, kind of enjoyed it after doing theatre.
Yeah.
You know, doing the same thing over and over again. Because I was always finding new things every time I performed the scene. So, and it's your job to make it fresh, and it's your job to the repetition is a part of the art of it. If you're in a band, if Guns N' Roses are doing Sweet Child of Mine and they go on stage that night and go, oh, it's the thousandth time I played it, I can't be arsed anymore. You get, well, there's someone out there who hasn't heard you play Sweet Child of Mine and it's their favourite song. You just got to learn the art of repetition and understand that that's part of the game.
It's finding what is different in there, and you'll know this. Again, I want to talk about riding the low because I think that feels like it's been key for you coming into your own and finding yourself. And exactly, but I always used to get asked, like, how do you do
like a 2 month tour, you're playing the same song over and over again. And my answer was always like, yeah, but the crowd's different every night.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's not the same song over and over again because there's a different connection there. But I don't want to keep banging on about working class because that can seem like over the top. But I really like your breakthrough on the stairs there in Broadway, on Broadway. Because I think, again, there's a working class thing when coming into these industries that there's something in the back of your head that's like, they all actually know something I don't. And it's all a big secret. And I have to fake it. I have to pretend. I'm pretending, but I don't actually... It's an imposter syndrome, which I think is a syndrome almost exclusive to working class people. And I love that moment of going, oh, hang on, there's not a big secret. There's not some big hidden thing. You've just got to go and tell... That's all it is. You're going and telling the story. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. It's just conditioning, Pip. It's just... Yeah. There is no great conspiracy about it. It's just really our conditioning. And once you sort of realise that, then the world can open up to you and you understand that it's everybody's privilege. You know, yeah, we come from tougher backgrounds, but maybe, you know... There's also that sense within those worlds, and I never really got this from my parents, of you to just stay in your lane and stop dreaming and stick to what you know, mate, and all that kind of stuff. I think I think in my experience, you kind of apologize for success, so I don't really know how to behave around people because I feel awkward being successful from that. I don't think we know how to deal with success in the same way.
Yeah. 100%.
But it's a process I think you have to go through, and ultimately you have to let go of, and because it just holds you back. Thinking things aren't for you. Like I remember doing like my Summer of Love years ago, and Natalie Press was in that, and she was talking about Shakespeare, and I was very, very dismissive of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was for clever people. I thought it was for, you know, posh people, and you know, and I didn't understand a word of it. And I says, oh, fucking Shakespeare. And she went, oh, well, that's a shame. And I went, what do you mean? She went, well, you're just robbing yourself of a privilege there, of a whole world there. And I was like, oh, I never looked at it like that. So years later, when I did do Shakespeare, and I actually sat with somebody and I read the text, it was like everything came to life. And I went, I could see it. I can see what this means. It was like a revelation. I'm going, it's just text. It's just words. If I reframe it in this context and say it in my common tongue, all this character is basically saying is, and then once you make that revelation, then all of a sudden the world's opened up to you and you can perform Shakespeare.
I think there's a big realisation, isn't there, that these things are successful for a reason. Like, again, I'm not religious, but the Bible had some fucking great stories in. I was dismissive of religion for a long time. And then it's like, no, some of these stories are glorious. It's the same. I had exactly the same with Shakespeare. And it was a working class friend of mine and Kay Tempest that opened me up to that. Because Kay was mad about Shakespeare and was like, one of the all-time greats, obviously. And it was like, oh, okay. And you give it a look. Yeah. But again, speaking of kind of things are successful for a reason, how was it stepping onto a show in the world of the biggest TV show of all time in Game of Thrones, in a huge role as well, in House of Dragons as King Viserys Targaryen. How did you balance that out, stepping on and becoming part of that? Because, as I said, the most successful TV show of all time, essentially, and I think an absolutely astounding piece of story telling over its arcs. Exactly as you're saying, it's one that I dismissed for a long time. And then I binged, I think, the first three seasons. And in about season three, I was like, the way that all of these different stories are weaving and are woven, and the, as stupid as it sounds, the geography involved of telling these stories in this world is astounding. But that comes with pressure, right? To jump into that world, I guess.
Do you know, I never felt that pressure because I knew that it was something that I couldn't take on. It was something I could not, I would not be able to deal with it in any way. And I really didn't struggle with that. I thought, you know, this thing is a massive piece of work, that the world is established through the show. What the journey those actors must have gone on would have been phenomenal, life-changing for them. But I thought on my shoulders, I cannot carry the weight of what's gone before me. It's impossible. I can't do it. I couldn't imagine it. So I just did the only thing that I could do, and I played the role of King Viserys Targaryen.
Yeah.
And that was it. I just thought, I can't take all those
things on. Just got to tell the story.
Just got to tell the story.
I love it.
You know, even if the show's a hit or not, it's not my problem. I've just got to tell the story. Yeah. I've just got to play him as faithfully and as honestly as I possibly can. And that's what I did. So, because you can't take that on. I can't take that on my shoulders. It's not my responsibility to carry. My responsibility is to play him to my best, the best of my ability. And that's all I did.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I remember when it was the cast announcements were starting to come out and you were announced Olivia Cooke, Matt Smith, Reese Ifans, really amazing cast being put together. And crucially, because I think it's one of the crucial parts of Game of Thrones, a load of people I'd never heard of.
Yeah.
Because again, I think that was always a key part of it. It would have been horrible if this was just, well, now it's a big show. Here's all the big Hollywood names. Everyone announced have been in indie movies I've loved. And as stupid as that sounds as an important thing, it was a really important thing. So how was it as the cast started to come together and you all started to figure out how you're going to tell this story?
Well, I mean, the response to me getting offered it, because I didn't audition for the part, was a little bit like, I won't say I struggled with it, but my agent was very much like, look, they haven't gone to anybody else. I said, why have they asked me to do it? And he said, well, you know, they could have had pretty much anybody they wanted.
Yeah.
And I said, well, why didn't they then? You know, and it's like, well, because they've come to you with it.
They did, Paddy. They did.
Yeah, they did. They came to you. It's yours. Yeah. And once I sort of accepted that, and once I got the green light, you know, Miguel, who's the director of the show, who directed a lot of the first series as well, he just says, we did a read-through and he said, we need to put more Paddy into this. Because, you know, read-throughs are horrible, Pip. You know, everybody's there doing their best RP and it's an awful scenario. I mean, because it was like post-COVID thing, we did our read-through in a room and it looked like Dr. Strangelove. It was just, it was bizarre.
Yeah.
Everyone was like 10 meters apart in this. It looked like we were in a starship trying to do a read-through. And it was the most unnatural thing. Screens and mics and all this shit. But when he said that to me, because we need to put more Paddy into it, I went, right. All right, if that's what you want, that's what you're going to get.
I love it.
And it just gave me the license because I think as well, Pip, I don't want to digress so much, but because I wasn't trained, a lot of my early performances were improvisational and I could do that all day. But all of a sudden I'm being given a script and it felt like I had handcuffs on. I'm going, now I've got to say exactly what's on here. And it felt like school. And I hadn't learned the art of seeing the music in it and seeing the freedom in it. So acting to me suddenly became a memory test of me remembering lines. Yeah. And it was affecting my performance. So I had to learn new techniques to be able to act. And one of them was absolutely knowing the text, completely knowing it. Repetition, letting it dissolve in you. And then the more I did that, the more I found that I had more freedom. I'm like, I'm not having to think about this anymore. Now, that's stuff that comes quite naturally, you know.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's the beauty of it, isn't it? Like, once it's in there, that's when you find the freedom, rather than going, well, I'll learn it loosely and I'll be a bit free with it. It's like, no, once it's a second nature, that's when it's the same with music, mate. It's the
Absolutely,
same with music.
Yeah.
As soon as you really know them songs, I always feel an album is finished halfway through the tour after the album has come out. And it's broken my heart with every record I've ever released. It's like we release the record, then halfway through the tour, I'm like, I know it now. I know this song properly. It's changed. It's evolved. I needed to repeat it for, you know, a month. And exactly the same in acting, right?
Yeah, it gives you freedom and then you start to feel free of it. And my only thing was I'd never learned how to really interpret a script, silly as that seems. You know, it's pretty fundamental if you want to act.
Yeah.
But going back to the casting of it all, I mean, you know, working with those guys, with Matt Reese, there's so many great casts, Emma, Olivia, there was so many, and the young cast, Millie, everybody was brilliant. If I try to mention every member of the cast, and I'm going to be here for the next half an hour.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, Fabian, it was one of the great things about the show was we all got on brilliantly.
Fantastic.
And we were all about the work, and we really, really enjoyed working with each other. So yeah, to me it was a really great thing working with all those people. I loved it. I had a great relationship with Matt. Reese was we had a great old gaff with them. And people thought me and Reese had worked together loads of times. We hadn't worked together at all.
Yeah.
But we just, you know, we just got on so well, and we just seemed like we were old friends or something. But yeah, we were really mucked in. And
it's great to hear. It's great to hear the love of it as well, because particularly with bigger productions, it can sometimes get to the point. I know I've been on sets where I'm there buzzing because I can't help myself. It's mad to me. I'm part of this world now. It's a fucking honour. But
yeah,
there's a lot of people who it feels like the amazing bit of art that we're making is kind of an imposition. It's kind of ruining their day a little bit. And they're like, let's get this done. Do you know what I mean? So it's great to hear.
It's a fine line.
Yeah, it's great to hear when there's a set where you are like, you're enjoying being there, but also you're enjoying the work. You're enjoying the thing that you're creating. It's not just... Because, again, I've equally been on those sets where everyone's getting on so well, it is kind of a bit annoying. Oh, do we have to do the actual thing now? I'm just enjoying messing about with my pals. It sounds like a perfect balance there, that you all got on that well, but maybe that connection was partly through the fact that you were all had this amazing thing that you were excited to work on and passionate about.
But also, Pip, aside from that, it was just like, I think we all respected each other. I think we all had respect for each other's work. And so we all knew we were working with good people, and nobody stood out above anybody else. You know, there was no hierarchy. We were just like a company.
Yeah.
You know, so that was really good. That helped it. But you've got to protect that thing. On a production like Game of Thrones, you've got to protect the thing that's precious, and that's the performance and the character, because mm-hmm. these things can get lost in the machinery of everything. Yeah. And I think if I'm guilty of anything in the past, is just that I've allowed it to happen. Like, you have to fight for a lot as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really do. And I think there was a point for me in the last decade where I just stopped fighting for stuff. I'm going, I can't be bothered to fight for anything anymore. I'm trying to put nuance into this and life into this. These guys want to go home. They're on a schedule and all that. And I'm not holding anybody up or being a pain in the arse. I just want it to be the best it can possibly be. And I think I just got to the point with some performances and some productions where I went, oh, you know what, fuck it. If you don't want what I bring, then fuck it, because it's not worth fighting for. It's just making me exhausted, and it's making me ill, and it's not worth fighting for if you're not interested. So you have to protect that kind of thing. Yeah. And Miguel went in there and dug out all the good shit that we knew we were bringing. Yeah. And that's another great thing too, to know that, because there's so many times you see a performance and you go, I know we did better than that. I know there was more interesting stuff than that.
Yeah.
But this one, they seem to have dug it out. You know, Miguel seems to have gone in and found it. And you're going, thank God, because I know that it was there.
Yeah.
Because we shot that scene that day. But, you know, it was just an exciting thing. I had that. See, I have a thing, Pip, as well, where I've had a funny relationship with acting over the years. And that's been interpreted that people think I hate acting. I don't. It's just what we've spoken about is like it's made me look at the ugly side of myself.
Right.
It's been quite scary sometimes, which sounds silly. I'm not going in a boxing ring and getting knocked about. But that imposter thing was so strong that when something comes up in acting or a role comes up that's challenging, it makes me very, very vulnerable, because I have to confront all these things again and again. So I always had a bit of a funny relationship with it, because it brings out all the doubt in me. It brings out all the demons and all the shit. I'm no good at this. I'm rubbish at this. And people's bad comments, you know, this guy's not a good actor or whatever it is. Part of my freedom was realizing that I can't fulfill other people's expectations. I can only do my best. And what your aspirations for me, if that's great that you've got these fantastic aspirations and you think by now I'd be working with X, Y, and Z and all, but I'm just fucking Paddy trying to do his best. This is my story, and I can't take any of that on. So I love acting, but I felt guilty for years, because I'd be on set with Simon Pegg. And Simon would be going, isn't this exciting? We're on the stage where they shot the scene for the Rancor monster, you know, in Return of the Jedi. And Simon loves cinema, loves acting, and he's one guy that's worked with pretty much everybody that was a kind of inspiration to him, you know?
100%.
But I remember like him saying, oh, isn't it exciting when you get to set and the lights come out and they start to get the cameras out? And I felt bad because I thought, I don't feel like that at all.
Right.
I don't feel like, I don't get that buzz of excitement.
Yeah.
I get a buzz when I'm waiting for Metallica to come on and I'm literally in the wings watching the stage crew take down what, you know, and check this. And I'm going, oh, I get it there.
Yeah.
And so I thought there was something wrong with me. I thought, well, I'm not like that. And then I realised there's nothing wrong with you, mate. You don't. This is your relationship to acting. Nobody else's. This is exclusive to you.
Yeah.
You don't have to love it all the time. You don't have to be that guy. Yeah, sometimes it asks demanding things of you. You don't have to do it, by the way. Sod off and do something else. But it challenges me in a way that sometimes frightens me. And that's okay, man. I don't have to love it. I just have to turn up and do the work. Luckily, I loved Viserys Targaryen, so, you know, it made life easier.
That's a perfect situation. I want to talk a little bit more about Miguel, because I think it's a weird thing in this industry. It's been talked about a load, but film, everyone talks about the directors. TV.
Television, they don't.
No one talks about the directors. And one of my questions here was, it's a huge production. How did you make sure you grounded yourself as an actor and grounded your performance and didn't get lost in the production? And it sounds like it was Miguel. It sounds like that note of Miguel saying, we need more Paddy, is absolutely key to that grounding. So, yeah, how is that? How is that working with someone who clearly kind of gets you and, from the sounds of it, loves actors? Because not all directors do, but loves actors, really like cares, you know?
No, they don't. They think, turn up, do your thing, and off you go. But, yeah, no, I notice in me that I need to trust people, you know, and if I trust people, I will do whatever it takes. And, like, for example, I worked with Sam Mendes, and I trusted him so implicitly.
Yeah.
Working with him was transformative for me. It was a massive turning point in my life, working with him. I got to talk quietly because he's actually next door doing a screening. But it was transformative. I trusted him.
Yeah.
And I had the same thing with Miguel. My relationship with Miguel was such that I absolutely trusted him. And on this, I worked with four different directors, Miguel being one of them. But he was always the person that I went back to, because what happens sometimes on things like this is that each director starts to tell their own story and not the story. And I had one director giving me notes about a character. And it was too far down the line. We're too far down the line now. This isn't about your idea of King Viserys. I am now King Viserys. And I will tell you how this man goes about his life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you're stepping into my world now.
Yeah.
And I think some of that sometimes got a little bit lost along the way. Have faith in me.
Yeah.
I am King Viserys Targaryen.
Mate, and I know him. I agree. That witnessing that exact thing on set early on was one of the breakthroughs for me as an actor as well. I was doing a big American TV show, and there was we had to stop filming at some point because there was a bit of a clash between an actor and the director who was on for that episode. And again, I'm big on respecting everyone's art, and I went outside with the actor as everyone was kind of cooling off a little bit, and he explained that they were shooting the pilot for a month. They shot episode two for almost a month. Like, this has been a long project. We were now on episode five or six. And although it was a small thing, there was a nuance there that he was like, I know this character now. And I understand. Again, he was completely respectful. He was like, I understand from the director's point of view, he thinks visually, if the character steps in this way or approaches this, the problem is that's not the character. You know, the director is looking at this particular scene as character A and character B. I'm looking at it as the complete character, if you know what I mean. And again, that was a real, I thought at first he was being unreasonable. As soon as we went outside and talked, exactly as you said there, it's like, no, you've got to trust him. He knows this character. He's all these episodes in. And the directors, again, the way TV works, the director working on episode four won't have been able to watch episode one, episode two, episode three, unnecessarily. It moves too quickly. That's not how it works. So you need to trust the people who were there. You need to trust the people who are in the story.
Yeah, and that's not to say that I don't, I'm not open to notes and direction. I love that getting out. If someone can give me a note that changes it by an increment, I'll explore it. And, you know, that's another thing. Miguel was great at that. But if you try and feed me nonsense, then I'll resist. You know, if I smell that, if I think that you're a bullshit artist, then, you know, it's going to be kind of problematic. There's a difference, I think, Pip, in caring and people who are just being a pain in the arse.
Yeah.
And it's egotistical. And I think the now, after the few years that I spoke about, I just feel like, it's worth fighting for the things that you care about.
Mm.
And ultimately, that's what's great about Miguel, because he saw that. And then he looked at the rushes and he looked at the different episodes and was like, it's all there.
Yeah.
It's there. And that's reassuring to know. It's not about being creativity, as you'll know, Pip. It's not about being wrong or right.
Nah.
It's got nothing to do with it.
Nah.
There is no wrong or right.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, well, speaking of fighting for what you care about, can we talk a little bit about the Journeyman? Or about Journeyman, sorry, because we've spoken privately a bit about this, and honestly, it's one of my favourite films of all time. I think it's absolutely astounding. And I want to talk about the struggles or the challenges of making it as an actor and as a director, and then talk a little about the challenges of releasing and the battle that comes there. So how was that to work? And it was your second feature as a director. It's about a boxer. I know boxing is very close to your heart. It's a heartbreaking story and a brutally honest story. How was the process of writing it, of becoming the character, of directing? How was all of that?
I think I just... It began years ago with me writing a short story, actually. Well, a sort of synopsis come short story that I wrote. And it was about a fighter. It was basically, first of all, it was sort of based around stories that one of my like closest and oldest friends had told me, who was a pro boxer, is the same age as I am.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just about his life as a sort of semi-journeyman fighter in a way, just how he could be plastering the walls and then get a phone call and he'd be at work and then the phone would go and it's like, what are you weighing at the minute? Can you get to Dublin tonight? You know, he'd literally go and get his passport, get on a plane, fly to Dublin, sit in a hotel, fall asleep, get a knock at 1 o'clock and go, you're on.
Yeah.
You know, and I wanted to do something about that world of the journeyman fighter that hadn't been seen.
Because all we've been told is the high end of it.
You know,
the Rocky story, the fighting for a world championship rather than the people along the way.
Yeah, but I remember seeing also a documentary about Michael Watson years ago, mm-hmm. and it showed his struggles. And I remember seeing him, you know, because I'd watched that fight with Chris Eubank, the rematch, and I remember like it having a massive impact at the time because it was on terrestrial TV. Millions of people saw it. It was very much in our consciousness as a public.
It was the era of Eubank and Ben and Collins, and all of these guys were such a... That
and
division
boxing,
was so...
Yeah, boxing then as well, Pip. You know, yourself, it potentially could make the front pages sometimes of the press, which was the big thing. It was definitely made the back page.
Yeah.
And that was the big... That was a sort of moment that was quite sort of monumental in people's minds. But then I remember... I don't know if it was months or a year or so after seeing a photograph of Michael Watson and him being on the pitch at Arsenal because he was an Arsenal fan and he was sat in his wheelchair and he had his like fist up and stuff. And I remember looking at it going, good God. And the idea was, you know, there was all these well wishes. Look, Michael's battling on, Michael's strong. And I remember looking at that picture going, what's he been through in the last year? What must that guy have been through? It's like, And then this documentary came on that told that story years later of Michael's rehabilitation, and it was a tough road.
Mm.
But I think that's where the beginnings of the idea came for Journeyman, was like, what happens when the crowds go away? What happens when, you know, with something severe as an injury, who is really there to look after you at the end of it? It's something that boxing doesn't want to look at. It's the ugly side of it, but it's a reality of it. And I thought nobody's really, in a filmic way, told that story at all. So that was where the beginnings of it sort of came, I suppose. It's like just what happens when the crowds go away and the doors close and it's just the family left to deal with this trauma. Yeah. What happens?
Yeah. How was it shooting? You said, for example, on House of Dragons, you know when you've got the good, you know when you've got a good take in there, you know when the work has been done, but then it's in the hands of other people. It's different when you're the director as well, right? The one that instantly springs to mind was, how did it feel when you rapped on the day of the phone call scene? Because again, I think that scene stands up with any scene in cinematic history. And I'm looking away because I know you're not a fan of compliments and praise anyway, but I think it's an astounding piece of cinema. And it blows my mind to think of you as the actor in there, but then also as the director and playing two roles as such. So
yeah.
how were days like that to go, it's delivered. I'm seeing it from both sides.
It's weird, Pip, because like there's a few things in it. I mean, that phone call scene that you're on about, that was one take only.
Right.
That was, there's odd times in acting and in anything, and you'd know, again, performing where you transcend. And when I did that phone call, I can honestly say I was not in my own body anymore. Yeah. It was one of those moments where, and I'm not dressing it up or making it wanky. That's the thing that you try to touch a lot. And you experience it more in theatre, really, because you have the space for that to happen. Yeah. But I just wasn't in my body. That's that moment of that phone call was the purest performance I've ever done in my life.
Yeah.
I just wasn't aware. I was that guy in that situation on that phone in that moment.
Yeah.
And it's like you leave your body. My problem with Journeyman, I thought I had a strong story. The weird thing that happened to me, the process of making that film, was that I became so absorbed in the characters that I somehow failed to direct it.
Right.
And by that I mean that I stopped sort of, when I made Tyrannosaur, I wasn't in the world. I was outside it, even though I'd written it, and I was able to sort of work from outside it. When I was with Journeyman, I was so far in it that I sort of neglected in a way to direct it. So when I came to the cutting room, there were shots missing. There were things missing from it. There was stuff I was going, you didn't get that shot of you. The little things you need to do an edit. It hadn't found its groove the way that Tyrannosaur knew from the beginning what it wanted to be. It was like, I'm going to be made. This is how you're going to make me. And this is how you're going to present me to the world. Journeyman was different. I lost myself in it. And when I went to the edit suite, I was looking at the footage going, where's the fucking shots? Like, where? And I was like, oh, God. I just felt like I got so steeped in the characters and the story that I'd forgotten to direct it, which sounds insane.
That's really interesting. It makes sense as well, though, because, again, it's such an absorbing world and role that how can you be performing those scenes and then popping out and going, right, let's see what we got. Do you know what I mean? I can completely understand that. Does it tempt you at all? I don't know if you've got any plans to direct again. If so, would you want to direct yourself again, or would you rather go back to the Tyrannosaur way of going, well, when I'm an actor, I'm an actor, and when I'm a director, I'm a director?
I actually think I could do a better job of directing myself now, but
would I want to?
There was a different joy in being off camera, you know, for Tyrannosaur. There was a different level of involvement. I loved it. It was something else. So I think, I do think I would direct another film. I don't want Journeyman to be my last. I have a strange relationship with Journeyman. I don't know why, but it attracted a lot of darkness, and I still don't understand it now.
Well, we spoke a little bit at the time of release, because I kind of got very much a vibe that you were having a rough time, and part of that, I think, was around. It's one of the things that troubles me the most in this industry is I fucking adore films and the cinema. I love TV as well, but films and the cinema are the things I adore. But getting people into the cinema now, if it's not a big blockbuster, is so fucking hard. And I think you experience that with Journeyman. It's interesting now to know that you maybe had doubts over what you'd made because of
the cutting process. Did.
So that probably made it even harder. I know, again, I've always said, if you make something you're proud of, it's so easy to not care if it's successful or not. Because you can go, right, I know it's what I wanted it to be. If it doesn't fit in the world, that's fine. Yeah. I made what I wanted. Whereas if you've got any doubts over that, then you're going to have that. It's going to hit harder if it's not getting the numbers you want or whatever else it may be.
That's exactly it, Pip. I it's everything you described then. With Tyrannosaur, I couldn't give a fuck. I'd made the film that I wanted to make.
Yeah.
I worked my arse off on it. It was a dream making that film. And I remember watching the last time I watched it, I was in Soho. We watched it at the Curzon and it was a cast and crew. And I just sat there and I was like, I could not have done any better at this point. And I had a sense of fulfillment with it. And that's fucking important.
Yeah.
You know, you should be able to like your work. You should be able to feel fulfillment from it. It's allowed.
Yeah.
And I felt a massive sense of that with Tyrannosaur. I went, that is exactly the story that you wanted to tell.
Yeah.
With Journeyman, no. I felt like I was just in so much doubt. I just couldn't. And I knew I hadn't made as great a film as I set out to make in my mind.
It's astounding to hear, mate, because as I've said, I adored it, but now I want nothing more than to see the film you wanted to make. Because again, I love the film you made, but again, it's because you've got that comparison in your head, or you've got those moments that I don't know, if you know what I mean. Me as a viewer is going, I've watched it as this is exactly what you wanted to put across, and I'm adoring it. Whereas you're watching it with that scene isn't quite what I had in mind, and that angle and that this moment and that moment aren't quite what was originally in my head, so it's a different experience.
Yeah, but I think as an experience, if the art is making it, then it was an incredible experience.
Yeah,
it was brilliant. The actors were great. We had a great time making it. That was all brilliant. The journey of making the film was really great. But it's almost like afterwards, when it was there's no response to it, and I couldn't get it in a festival, and nobody saw Tyrannosaur at the cinema, but it was a festival darling. It was like it went to Sundance and won awards. And then, you know, unfortunately, that's how the world works, because people see an award-winning film and everyone jumps on it. And it ended up winning over 30 awards worldwide for various things. I mean, it was ridiculous. Every other week it was like, oh, you've won here, you've won there. But Journeyman, it was like, oh, there's this... It was like, you know, you were in the back garden screening it and everyone just shut their curtains and went, nah, you're all right, mate. We'll watch fucking Love Island or something. It was just, there was nobody was interested in it whatsoever. And I suppose that was hurtful. I understand it's a very, very brutal thing. And there's no privilege in a way that I did not expect doors to open for me. There wasn't a sense of entitlement about Journeyman. But I was just amazed that nobody wanted it. I went, it can't be that fucking bad. You know, it's
bad.
But when I say it's not what I wanted to make, I just think it was a massive learning curve because, you know, it taught me about not wanting anything from, you shouldn't want anything from your work. You shouldn't want, I think a part of me, Pip, if I'm really honest, was saying, I'm here. Here I am. I can do this, this, and this. I'm not just the man in the green coat from Dead Man's Shoes. You know, I'm not just somebody else's actor. I'm Paddy fucking Considine, and I've written, directed, and acted. And it's like everyone went, we don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
You know, we're not bothered. And a part of me's trying to go, but I'm more than that. I'm more than you're fucking there, mate. I'm more than that.
Yeah.
You know, but hey, you shouldn't even be battling with that shit. You should just be telling your story. All that other stuff is just distraction. It's nonsense.
Exactly.
Just tell your story, create your art. Fuck the outcome.
You
turned into something else. You know, the rock and roll left you for a minute and you turned into somebody that wanted to be seen, that wanted success for something. And it's like, you don't determine that. You just be a fucking artist and tell your story.
On the inside of the industry, all industries of the arts, that's how it's channeled. I remember that with music, breaking in with stuff that we didn't expect anyone to hear and then getting in the charts and then suddenly going, oh, how do I get higher in the charts? Oh, how do I compete with this person? And then I had to have a moment of going, oh, actually, no, fuck. The reason it worked originally was because I wrote my stuff in my bedroom at my mum's house. You know, no, I didn't expect the world to hear it. So all of a sudden, I'm going, well, we got in the charts with that, or we got on Radio 1 or whatever. How do we get on again? It's like, no, who gives a fuck? Just make your shit and
but that's what attracted people to you was the way that you made it. Yeah. The way that you went about it and what you presented, that's what attracted people. And then we get this thing where we go, well, we need to change that now. There's suddenly all this other anxiety that we need to perform in a different – well, this thing you've created needs to perform better.
Yeah.
And it's just a trap. It's just one of those things that traps you. It's like, no, I've just got to do what I've got to do.
Well, I want to talk about music, but before we get to that, I just – when you were saying about – sitting in the Curzon and watching the cast and crew screening of Tyrannosaur, the kind of the pride you felt. How's it been watching Olivia Colman get adored by the world? Because I worked with her recently on a BBC thing and I think she's astounding. But I think Tyrannosaur was her moment of like Kathy Burke in Kneel by Mouth. In Kneel by Mouth was the bit to go, oh, this is what Kathy's capable of. And Tyrannosaur feels like that with Olivia, who's then gone on to win Oscars and everyone realised how great she is. But prior to that, I don't think people knew the dramatic chops she had, you know, necessarily.
But also, Pip, she didn't know. She didn't know, you know. And I'm always honest about Olivia because as much as that's the revelation to the world, believe you me, that was a revelation to me too. I was witness to that journey. And I lit the fire. I'm not, I don't want credit for anything, but I mean, in terms of what Tyrannosaur was, you know, I lit a fire and she became a great actor through that process and I got to witness it.
Yeah.
And there's nothing greater than that. To see true transformation the way that I witnessed it.
Yeah.
It was a gift. It was an absolute gift. And man, my instincts were right.
Yeah.
You know? And I didn't have any proof that she could go to those places. She didn't know she could go to those places. She'd tell you that now, but she didn't. But we worked on it. We worked hard at pulling it out.
Yeah.
And once it was unleashed, well, you don't put that. You can't put it back in the box again now.
No.
You know?
No.
So it was. I thought it was a beautiful thing to witness. I'm so grateful for it that, and I'm grateful that she allowed me and trusted me to orchestrate where we got to.
Yeah.
It was like a fighter and a trainer, the relationship. It was complete trust. And Olivia's one thing, I just don't want to talk about Tyrannosaur and not credit how absolutely unbelievable Peter Mullen is in that film.
Absolutely astounding.
He's the heart of the film. But I mean, going back to her as well, I think when we made the movie, I was very much like, I wish to God I'd have written down on an envelope and handed it to her and gone, open that in 10 years' time. Because, you know, you could predict where it was going to go. And me and Peter talked about that on set.
Yeah.
We actually had a conversation and we should have put a few grand on where she would end up. It just seemed like a natural progression. But she, you know, it was a journey for her. You know, after the first week, I thought I'd made a mistake in casting. When I was actually casting the role, there was nobody else. It was her. And when I was talking to finances at the time, she'd made Dog All Together with me, the short film.
Yeah.
Well, who's going to play the lead? And I said, Olivia. And they were like, well, how do you know she can do that role? I said, I don't.
Yeah.
But, you know, something either high within me or something within me was like, but she is the one.
Yeah.
And it's none of my fucking business.
Yeah.
You know, whatever spoke through me that particular day when I met her was like, she's the one and that's it. So all I had was my faith in my instincts. But I knew that she had the will to go to those depths. The privilege was being allowed to take her there and the trust that she had in me. It was unique. It was and it was brilliant. I mean, it was one of the greatest things experiences I've ever had. But you know, people won't admit that they were suggesting other actresses to me.
Yeah.
You know, and they were trying to throw other people at me. And I was going, no, no, no. And the beauty of Olivia was in that role as that character was that she was a blank canvas.
Yeah.
Nobody knew
what
they were about to see. And nobody knew what she was capable of. Bring him to me now and I'll tell them they're a liar.
Yeah, yeah.
Because she didn't even know.
I love it.
So it was great. But just to say, Pip, the Kathy Burke thing, really, really important. The Kneel by Mouth thing. There wouldn't be a Tyrannosaur without Kneel by Mouth.
Yeah.
I went to watch that film, and I know Gary a bit now, you know. Mm-hmm. I've got to know him a little bit over the years. And I wrote Dog All Together. He was the first person that read it when I wrote Tyrannosaur, he was the first person to read it. And his only note to me was, don't change a fucking thing. That was his only note. And I went, all right, I won't. No problem. But that was a big one for me, seeing Neil by Mouth, Duke York Cinema Brighton. And I watched it and I went, this is about my life. It wasn't about my life specifically, but it's the power of film to talk to people, to speak to people and going, that's my sister, that's my mother, that's my father. It's not, but I understand the nature of this world.
Yeah.
And Neil by Mouth gave me the license to years later make Tyrannosaur, because it gave me the license to tell my own story.
Yeah.
And that was the importance of it. And of course, if you remember Kathy at the time, she was Harry Enfield's sidekick.
Yeah.
We'd seen her in dramas, but she was mostly known for Waynetta and things like that.
100%, yeah.
And being a comedy actress, similarities in a way to Olivia.
Yeah.
And Kathy at the time, that performance of hers was an absolute revelation. I mean, it was just 100%. Mind-blowing what she did.
Astounding.
And she's still one of the greatest. I love her to bits.
I completely agree. And well, I mean, we're running out of time completely. So let's just get a little bit of talking about the journey of riding at the low, because it feels like it's been an amazing few years. And the joy I get of watching you posting photos from photo shoots, photos from festivals, from live shows. How key is that to have your music in your life? To balance everything out?
Well, I've been like making music since I was a teenager, Pip.
Yeah.
And I've been in bands since I was like 16, playing drums and things like that. So it's all the first thing we ever did was playing music.
Yeah.
So it's just something I've always done and always loved. But I didn't start writing songs until I was in my late 20s. Yeah. And it's just something that I do. It's just something that I love. To me, it's as valid as the films I make. To me, sometimes it's more valid, you know.
Yeah.
I just love it. I love writing songs. I love performing. And we just put our third album out. But it's the first album that, funnily enough, that we've made together in a studio. And we're only just learning how to be a band in that way. The other first two albums weren't really made as a band, you know.
Yeah.
They were made, we recorded the nuts and bolts, and then they were, the stuff was put on elsewhere. But, you know, things are going really well. We've done some really good shows this year. We did Glastonbury the other week. We look like we're just about to sign with management, and you know, looked for a new album to come out in the spring next year. And so I find it really exciting. The hardest thing is it's a strange thing. I don't know if it's just this country or what we spoke about earlier. The mentality of people is that, you know, they see it as some sort of vanity project or some gimmick, and you go, it's just music. I have as much right to make music as anybody else.
I think people obsess over whatever point at which they got on the train. And again, I've had this with moving into acting and script writing and all these other things, is every message is about when are you coming back to music and this and that. But people don't know that prior to music, I was trying to make short films, I was writing scripts, I was trying to act, and then I was doing graffiti and street art. And then there was a point where I was doing music. That happens to be the point where most people boarded the train. Now we're somewhere else. It's hard for people to comprehend. And I think it's the exact in reverse for you. You've always done music, but people just didn't know about it. And now they're like, oh, what are you doing a music for all of a sudden? It's like, no, this isn't all of a sudden.
It's been there for years.
It's always
been
there.
You just didn't know.
Well, I mean, I'll round things up then by asking what's ahead, I guess. Acting, writing, directing, what's in your crosshairs, Paddy?
Well, at the minute, I mean, you know, I my wife always tells me off for saying there's nothing on the horizon, but I don't have any acting at work at the minute coming on.
Yeah.
So as far as I'm concerned, we're working on a new EP at the minute that we're recording. We've gone back to some older tracks that just weren't recorded very well and, you know, giving them a bit of a spruce up. And we're putting an EP out in a few weeks. They'll have some new stuff on it as well. And then I guess we'll be doing some more shows because we never properly toured the album. And then we'll be in the studio looking to get an album out next spring. So a lot of it at the minute is just music-based, you know, as we speak, which, you know, it's not fortuitous in any financial way because
Yeah.
We get about 300 quid a gig for riding the low, you know. But there's something about that as well, Pip. You know, I'm sitting in the hotel now in the Soho Hotel and all this is laid on and it's a big one and it's a HBO thing. Yeah. A couple of weeks ago, we were rocking up to Glastonbury in a van, you know, sleeping in the back of a fucking van, waking up with a bad back, and it puts you right back. You know, there's no privileges laid on for the band. It's just like, fuck, you know, this is odd.
I love it. There's before we go, there's two things I want to tell you, because I think they relate to everything we've talked about on acting journeys, on directing journeys. The two things that I think you'll enjoy about or knowing about the record label I used to run, but I've kind of closed it down now. Our slogan was, "We may not be for you, and that's fine." And again, I think that's a key mentality. And with every album I ever released of any artist, we celebrated when the artwork was submitted and the album went to press. We didn't celebrate on the day of release or on the day of finding out the chart position or the day of anything else. Once we had completed that piece of art, that was when we celebrated, because that's the fucking thing that counts. Everything after that, a lovely surprise and bonus, but that was the moment to celebrate, rather than, as you said before, when you're distracted by numbers or sales or radio or turnouts or box office or whatever else it may be. And I think it's the key way to do things, man. And it's easy to get drawn away from that in all of these industries.
Yeah, but the important thing, I think, is just to make sure you find your way back, because it's all right. It's okay. You know, I thought I was, you know, the difficult second album, you know, right, with regards to Journeyman. And I'm like, oh, no. No, because my first one was, you know, the zone that I was in making that, it made itself, and this will be the same. And it's not the same. Yeah. It's different. It's a different beast. And it's okay. Just come back. That's all right.
Well, I'm going to go peak radio now and say I'm glad you found your way back to the Distraction Pieces podcast, Paddy. It's been a joy catching up, mate. It's always a pleasure. And I can't wait to see House of Dragon and, everything else that's to come.
Pip, you're a good man. You're one of the best.
I love it.
You are. You really are a good soul.
Thank you, mate. I'll press stop there.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Paddy. I told you it was a good one. Dig into the back catalogue. And speaking of back catalogues, we're building up our Series 1 back catalogue of my new podcast, Tell Me About It with Scroobius Pip. So go and check that out on all podcast platforms now. And I'll be back next week with another amazing returning guest. I've had 3 weeks in a row, basically, we're going to have here, with previous absolute highlight episodes coming back years and years on. So, I'm excited to get this one to you as well. So, until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.